in the second-hand set of dimensions, on an astral plane that was never meant to fly, through wavering star mists, see the Greater Tuin. Drifting onwards through space, atop the shell of the world's turtle, are four giant elephants, upon whose broad shoulders rests the Discworld. Welcome to Dining Table Discworld. We're reading through the Discworld novels and discussing them at our dining table. Be aware, there will be spoilers for the current book, and others in the series.
Hello, welcome to Dining Table Discworld. I'm Dave.
I'm Kathy.
And today, we are talking about Weird Sisters, which is the sixth of the Discworld novels, originally published in 1988. Often considered one of the high point of this early section. Many people's favourite novel.
I guess so, yeah.
I think I've definitely seen it topping many, many people's lists of favourite Discworld novels, and the best starting point for if you wish to read the Witches sequence.
As we discussed in Equal Rights, which is not that.
Yeah. So, Kathy, what is the synopsis?
In the rural and mountainous kingdom of Lanka, King Verence has just been killed by his cousin, Duke Felmet, and his ghost is not happy about it. His infant son has been smuggled down to the castle and is handed to three witches who were just meeting on the moor and weren't looking for destiny to be thrust upon them. Veteran witches Granny Wefrax and Nanny Og and junior witch Magrat secretly pass the little prince to travelling players, then spend a year squabbling about how to handle the increasingly paranoid and hostile new ruler and his sadistic wife. Responding to the kingdom's displeasure, Granny gets the other two to help her interfere with time and help destiny along. Meanwhile, after explaining propaganda, the Duke's long-suffering fool is sent out to find a troupe of actors to help rewrite history and finds two prodigies of the theatrical arts in Ankh-Morpork. Witches, a ghost, and a storm will converge on Lanka Castle as fates are decided in a show-stopping final act.
There we go.
Oh, just as a content note, the book depicts sexual harassment and names it as such. There's also references to historic child abuse and self-harm.
So, what was your first?
So this is one that I read, I think, quite a few times, but I hadn't read it, well, I guess most Discworld, I've not read in a while, the early stuff. But yeah, this is one I definitely remember liking and reading a few times when I was a teenager. And yeah, I liked it again. There was bits I'd forgotten. But yeah, no, I still like it. Well, it's a mashup of Hamlet and Macbeth. I was one of those kids who did youth theatre and was very good at English Lit, and I generally have a reasonable idea what's happening in Shakespeare plays. I'm pretty familiar with Macbeth, having been in a school production or studied at school and also seen a couple of versions. I'm actually less familiar with Hamlet, even though that's super famous, but I have seen The Lion King, so I've got the basics of it.
My knowledge of Macbeth and Hamlet comes from The Lion King and this book. But then again, I am not a Shakespeare liker.
No, that's fine. I suppose I was just one of those people who was quite into both English and drama, like at school, and was in a youth theatre group and knew people who would read Shakespeare for fun.
I was in a theatre group, thank you very much. I just studied to do pantos, so you know.
It's not like my youth theatre group did. They didn't do pantos, they didn't do Shakespeare either, they did other stuff. But there were quite a lot of people I knew who like were into this sort of thing. And yeah, and I mean, obviously it came up when I was doing drama at school.
Yeah, that's fair.
And also, like, I'm a person that has a favourite Shakespeare play, which admittedly is a comedy. But yeah, and then I was in school, I was what ended up being called one of the little witches. So you have the three main witches in Macbeth. And then some of us who were a couple of years younger than them had turned up at the wrong rehearsal and were kind of extra. And they're like, oh, well, these girls can just be like kind of background witches, like witch backing singers, but not singing. So we'd just be there in like weird outfits and kind of like hiss and look a bit grotesque at the audience. So just added a bit of atmosphere to it.
As you do.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a good introduction to the witch characters. Yes. Well, initial three. It's a good time. It says a lot of... It's getting into quite meaty stuff, which obviously Pratchett books do, but I think it's happening increasingly as we're going through the series. Like, Equal Rights is sort of about gender, but not saying a lot, whereas this, I think, is getting into more...
Yes. So you like it then?
Yeah. How about you?
Yes, I do. I think it is one of the ones I've read more of. Certainly the Witches sequence, I've read this one more than, say, Witches Abroad or even Masquerade. I think I've read this one a lot more. It definitely has my best, what I enjoy, one of the best first paragraphs in Discworld, as far as I'm concerned. Well, he's doing the witches on the moor and the storm and the lightning and, you know, the cackling and the when shall we three meet again? And it's obviously Nanny Ogg goes, well, I can do next Thursday.
Yes.
I just think it's, you know.
Because I remember quite a lot of the witch speeches from Macbeth, because even though it was a long time ago and it was before I'd read Discworld, obviously being like a kind of background, which... I was there when most of those lines were done, and it does stick in the head quite well.
Yeah. And it uses a lot of sort of touchstones. We're going to use they're things of movies and sort of plays that it uses throughout.
Well, it's about stories, isn't it?
Yes.
But I think stories and performance and words is a major theme of it.
And throughout, you've got a Shakespeare character. So, excellent book. I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
There we go. Job's done. We have quite a long list of characters. Shall we start?
With the witches.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah. So we have a witch we've met before.
Yes, Granny.
Granny Weatherwax. This is not the Granny Weatherwax we met in Equal Rights. Or at least there's parts of her that are, but...
This is Granny in her natural habitat. There's not so much of, like, the borrowing is only in this little bit.
In this one,
But there is stuff about sensing a mind, because there's the mind of the kingdom later, and it does reference that she's, you know, done
She does cast her mind out to, you know. So, yes, we don't have the literal stuff, but, you know.
But Granny's very prim and proper, and, you know, she's not for that sort of thing.
She's an old school witch.
Yes.
Very big on the headology.
Yes. But again, she's very prim and proper and, you know, can't be having with that sort of thing.
Yes.
It puts her in kind of opposition and contradiction to the other old school witch we have, which is Nanny Ogg.
Yes.
Who is also an old lady. This is her first introduction, but she's this sort of like very raucous, I want to say saucy, but I'm not sure that's quite right.
Yeah.
But sort of like...
It's Maria Margolis.
Yes.
I'm pretty certain most people put Dreamcasting down. It's Nanny Ogg would be Maria Margolis. It's very, you know... Physically yes. and kind of, yeah,
yes.
definitely.
So she's, was it, the adventure, having an adventurous girlhood.
Yes.
It's clear that Granny judges Nanny for being, well, I guess now I would say sex positive.
Yeah.
I think then it was, well, promiscuous is probably the politest term, and then there are some other terms that were less polite.
Well, she just had a lot of husbands.
I think it was just husbands, yeah.
But
she has got a lot of kids. The husband's never really mentioned. The one sort of assumes they're dead or not around. But yeah, she has a lot of kids. She has a lot of grandkids. But she's also still very much, you know, she likes her pipe. She likes her drink. She likes singing a rude song about hedgehogs.
She does, yes. And they're also very different. You've got Granny Weatherwax, who's the rural witch, who's lives up in in a cottage in the forest. And Nanny Ogg lives in
a house in the town
with a revolving door of family in and out, and you know.
Yes.
Whereas Granny's very much on her own with her animals and the wildlife.
Nanny's the one that has the cats, though. Granny.
True.
Granny
yes.
can't be with cats. And it's clear these are women that have known each other like all their lives.
Yes.
Also, we say the town. I feel like Lancashire's probably Free Street, but that is quite cosmopolitan for that area.
Yeah.
Like there's Free Streets and a castle. And then the third member of the coven, who actually convened it and called it a coven in the first place, is Magrat Garlic. So Magrat is what I guess would be called New Age.
Yes.
I don't know if it's still New Age at this point, but I guess it was New Age.
Yeah, definitely not
then.
Yeah.
You know, she's got a lot of silver jewellery and it's a lot of occult symbols. She doesn't have, you know, black and a pointy hat. She seems to be wearing like white or green dresses. And she's, I guess, girly. They don't have the word hippie. I think that's in there. So this is where it introduces the idea of witches kind of doing like apprenticeships or training each other up. So you'll have an older witch, you'll take on a younger witch who then takes over the cottage. Well, the witch that trained Magrat, Goody Wemper, may she rest in peace, was clearly very scientific. So
yes.
She has all these books and she made a lot of careful notes.
Grimoires.
Grimmers. So Magrat's sort of, because New Age is seen as like not terribly scientific, but then obviously Magrat's been raised, sort of been trained by somebody who is in that mode. So there's sort of an element of her like, you know, she wants peace and harmony. She, at one point, I think she talks about not eating meat and not doing violence. Although at the point she gets angry enough that she does. There's talk about nature and stuff quite a bit. And she's sort of half aware what its analogy is for, but not the full way. Whereas I think Nanny knows a bit more, because Magrat's a kind of an engineer a little bit.
Yeah.
But she's still learning her place. And she wanted to have the other witches around so she could learn from them. But largely it's two old women just squabbling at each other while she makes the tea.
She definitely had a view of this coven of witches where they would dance and sing under the moonlight. Again, she just gets to the two old ladies bickering and, you know, complaining about the tea. But they're interesting, you know, the views on witchcraft and witches.
Yes. Well, Magrat's also... Magrat's the one I found most relatable when I read it as a teenager, because based on when ages seem to be in Lanka, probably was not too dissimilar in her from age, although obviously she's out on her own, but again, it's a different sort of time. But there's also about how she's quite slim and flat-chested and also has to have tissues on her all the time because she sniffles a lot. And it's like, oh, well... That seems very relatable. I never had that much silver jewellery, but I do have silver jewellery that could be described as a cult, and probably more when I was a teenager, so yes.
Your hair is nowhere near as frizzy as hers, though.
Well, that's fair enough, thank you, I guess. and I think it's that thing Pratchett does, where he's got this book which focuses on, you know, these three female characters, and the whole series is going to focus largely on, if not these three, a parade of female characters. Granny is what you might call handsome. So she's like an older woman, but she doesn't have any warts, she has all her teeth, she doesn't look traditionally witchy, she just looks like a very stern old woman.
It's mentioned in this that she couldn't do warts, she had,
Whereas Nanny looks a lot more like a traditional witch. You know, she's lost most of her teeth because she had a lot of sugar.
Yeah.
You know, she's plump, but she's very plump and friendly, and she's Nan to like a lot of grandkids, and she's, you know, like our mum, our Nan kind of thing. Also, where Granny is seen as being this very aloof, very quite intimidating, scary figure, Nanny, as well as being a witch, is the midwife. She has delivered the babies. And this is the thing, which I mentioned equal rights, is that the witches are a community service. They're people that are working in their community and, you know, they're helping people with potions, with healing, with midwifery, with all sorts of things that just need doing. Magrat, it doesn't feel quite as much specialised, but again, I think, she, you know, she helps out with things. She, you know, she's done some births.
Potions would, I think, it would be very, you know.
Well, I know, because I think it's mentioned before, we're in equal rights that Granny does that quite a bit.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, they've both got gardens, because Magrat also lives in a cottage in the woods, because she, you know, inherited it from Goody Wemper. May she rest in peace. So, yeah, it's... I think Magrat's still kind of defining herself, but there is one bit where she runs into Seanorg, who's one of Nanny's sons. And he almost sort of says something like how she's not a proper witch. And then that just riles her up. So she goes out and does stuff. Because this is the thing. Magrat seems full of indecision and stuff, not quite being how she wants it to be. But then something will happen and she'll be like, right, this now. And then she will take action. Yeah. But she needs a bit of pressing to it. So yes, those are the weird sisters. Although apparently in Macbeth, the way weird was spelled in the first folio actually looked more like wayward.
Oh, okay.
But the thought is it's not weird like weird, say... Oh, that's strange or unusual. It's weird as spelled there, W-Y-R-D.
Yes.
Which, again, refers to the Celtic idea of fate or destiny, which also makes sense because obviously destiny is a big thing in the plot of this book.
That's kind of the whole deal, really, isn't it? So,
There is a line that says, there was nothing like a bit of destiny to get the old plot rolling.
Very much so.
Which I think is probably one of the playwright's lines, but also could just be Sir Terry making a comment about the book.
That's fair enough. Well, shall we move on to the ghost in the room?
Indeed.
the former king of Lankra, King Verence. So we have King Verence, who is unfortunately done in by his cousin, who definitely wasn't there and definitely did not stab him pushing down the stairs.
Yeah.
Definitely.
No one saw it happen.
No one saw it happen.
He was somewhere else. Definitely. He just fell.
Yeah. Who, unfortunately... for him, discovers that instead of going on to whatever comes next, he is going to be stuck haunting the castle.
With a load of other ghosts, because it's a very old castle.
Yes. And so we do learn about some of the other ghosts. It does kind of feel like the TV show Ghosts.
Yes, I thought that, which obviously came much later. But yes, this sort of idea that you've got all these ghosts layering in from different times, hanging about the place, just almost being stuck kind of in the habits they were in life. but also the stuff like... Well, in this, I think Varence actually has to focus not to fall down through the floor because he can't leave the property.
Yeah.
Then I think one of the ghosts is sort of helpful, makes a point about something not making much sense, which just reminds me of how in the TV show Ghosts, they can, like, sit on furniture but also walk through walls.
But yeah. So he's kicking around. I think initially he's just trying to get a witch on board. He's trying to get... So he can actually interact with the world a bit.
Well, Death sort of explains to him, oh, you're going to be a ghost, then kind of leaves. But he does mention that people who can detect him are close relatives and the psychically inclined. And witches are his main thought of who is psychically inclined. So yeah, he's trying to get a witch.
Both of those types of people that can see him are important to think about later.
Well, that's the thing, because I don't see King Varence as like... It's useful that he's there, and obviously if it's a mashup of Hamlet, it's going to have the ghost of the murdered king. But I don't feel like he's super characterful. He's just this bluff-hearted guy who was king and hasn't had to do a lot of thinking, but now he doesn't have a body to distract him from things, so he's actually had to learn thinking and is thinking better. So he at one point, through a lot of concentration, manages to move tiny things, but does manage to trap Nanny Ogg's cat. So, and it's like, well, if he's caught a witch's cat, then the witch will come. And that's how Nanny Ogg ends up in the dungeon. I feel like there's other characters more interesting, namely our villains. So, yeah, as you said, like, the Duke keeps being called the Duke, even though he's the king now.
Duke Felmet, who,
This is the second book Pratch has done like this in, because in Mort, you know, you've got the cousin of the king who murders him and then, in one version of things, becomes king. But everyone still calls him the Duke. And it's like, will he be the king now?
We don't see a coronation in the book.
No, but he's been king for over a year.
Yeah, the point is there is time that passes within the book that you just think he would have got crowned at some point.
Time that passes.
Yeah, although maybe it's because the crown's missing.
Well, no, because I think he still says he's king. I think the thing is that the narrative voice refers to him as the Duke or Felmet, and then all the characters when he's not there talk about him and call him the Duke. So I think it's probably this thing that he decided he didn't like early on. Everyone just kind of says it as like the tiniest sort of like rebuttal to him.
Yeah.
Because there's this whole thing that, oh, he's very tyrannical. But the previous king was, so he sets the cottages on fire. But King Varence did that too. But, oh, he only did it a little bit. And he did it in such a polite way. And
oh, no, he always let them out first.
Yeah. So it's the thing that comes up is, so Felmet... He doesn't like the country, which becomes a plot point and a sort of instigator of action. He's become king, but it's damp, and there are too many trees. Because as well as being very mountainous, Lanka is clearly very wooded. And, I mean, obviously again, it's a Macbeth mashup, so the trees coming trees to get
quite,
you.
Quite important, yes. But I think as well, he's pushed into this a lot by his wife.
Again, a Macbeth.
You know, she's very much, you know, she obviously wants a kingdom, wants a...
I think he does too, though.
I think he would have preferred a different kingdom, but this one was the easiest one to get.
Yes. So you got the whole kind of Macbeth, Lady Macbeth thing. And in this, she's obviously, I say big, like big in personality. I get the impression maybe fairly big in size, but just this sort of very imposing presence with no conscience and who's quite sadistic.
Yeah. You quite often see in you know, especially when we have these type villain characters in these, you get the lady who's the bigger, forceful one, and then you get the slightly meeker, you know...
Smaller guy. Yeah. I don't know, because I think it's more just he's incredibly imposing, you know, it sort of describes, I think one point she describes having a wall of red velvet, but is it just that she's such a big personality? I think that counts for a lot of it.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
And again, it's not said that Felmet's particularly small or short, but the thing with Felmet is he very clearly is being depicted as having a severe mental health issue.
Yes.
Which seems to be written kind of as what at the time was called manic depression, although now we call it bipolar. I don't think it is just that. And he also is obviously in terribly a very unpleasant, murderous character. But saying that, he has done a murder and he's so racked by guilt with it that it seems to be driving him insane. Whether that's just what's happening, because it sort of says stuff about how he kind of seesaws. He has like manic episodes and depressive episodes. So I think that's what's being alluded to. But again, I don't know how accurately or just more as a sort of trope. of a type of thing.
I think it was just playing more to the trope than actually, yes. You know, I think, because I think it is a trope. It is, you know, it's the, you know.
I think like mood swings and unpredictability, particularly, I guess, in the male character. Because, yeah, he thinks the trees are whispering about him.
Yeah.
Somebody mentions witches. He thinks the witches are whispering about him. So he's paranoid for sure.
He can't, it's Lady Macbeth, you know, blood on his hands. He can't see, you know, he's...
Yeah, I mean, that's where it's sort of... Again, the gender's been switched a bit. Yeah, he's the one who kind of needed almost, like, pushing to do the murder, which is Macbeth in the play. And then Lady Macbeth's the one who dragged with Gil. In this, the Duchess... No conscience, and clearly a sadist.
We'll do it again.
Yeah, enjoys torturing people, and not in like any kind of fun consensual way.
No.
Although there are references I did not get as a teenager that rather suggests that that is a thing that they also do. But they're,
I mean, whatever slightly... they got, whatever they do in their bedroom is entirely, you know, up to them.
But yeah, it's yes, the fact that he. And this is where the self-harm comes in. He thinks he can see blood in his hands, so he starts washing. But then he starts scraping and scratching. And then he starts using a file. And then later in the book, because a year goes past, well, probably a bit more than that.
It's at least a year.
Sort of literally a bit more than that in some points.
Yeah.
It mentions stubs and mentions what used to be a hand. So it's very clear that he is disfiguring himself. He'll get the torturer to send up a file or something. And it's not portrayed in a kind of like... spectacle kind of way, but it's clear when you read it that he has been just basically mutilating his hand.
Yes.
And there keeps being blood, and it's like, well, if you mutilate your hand, that is what will happen. But so that's like, I kind of needed something like that, but I think I saw it more and it's like, well, that's quite unpleasant, which is why I thought I'd mention self-harm, because like, well, actually that's quite nasty. And then there's a bit at the end where he thinks he's died but hasn't, and he always seems happy about it. Oh, I'm going to be a ghost. And it's like all the bad stuff's gone away and he's just quite excited.
I'm free of my physical form. I'm free of everything that, you know.
Yeah, he's clearly torturing himself. And again, like the trees are coming close because he wants to chop down all the trees and, you know.
Yeah, the witches are definitely talking about him and doing all the, they're out to kill him.
Yes. And yeah, so I think it's that he has these things he focuses on as hyper-focus for his, you know, his paranoia. And I mean, it's quite unpleasant in some ways, but it's like he's sort of, kind of torturing himself for what he's done, or at least, you know, his mental state is obviously incredibly unpleasant for him, but then obviously he takes out on everyone else because he's the ruler, whereas his wife's just this terrible villain.
Yes.
She's the one who quite often, you know, ignores him when he's kind of giggling to himself or something, and actually is kind of getting stuff done, albeit in a deeply horrible way.
Yes.
But yes, onto the fool, who I think is the other main character.
Yes, the fool who is your typical, I say typical, you know, classic medieval jester type.
Yeah, court jester, harlequin.
Bells on his hat, and is supposed to be the happiest person around. Well, the most, he's there to make everyone laugh. He's supposed to make everyone.
Yeah, well, now.
I think, no, this is the point. You know, the fool, you know, your traditional fool is there to act silly and make everyone laugh and bring him. And I think he's the saddest character there because he is a guild approved.
Well, this is the thing. So you have his grandfather was a fool, and so was his father, and so he had to join that way of life. It's very much the family business. There's the fact that they are guild approved. So you go to the guild in Ankh-Morpork, and I think earlier on when we were talking about books, I forgot that the Fool's Guild was definitely there. So the Guild of Fools—they do fools, they do clowns, they do mimes.
No,
okay, mimes don't exist now anymore. Well, but they might have done when he was younger.
True, but there's definitely no mimes now.
No. Again, when now is a fully concept. But...
okay.
But the whole thing is, they're supposed to be jolly and merry. And he keeps saying stuff like, i'faith and nuncle. And there's all these set lines. And the point is, you're supposed to be a clown. You're supposed to make people laugh. There are set jokes and there are set... And it basically describes an incredibly brutal... And this is where the historic child abuse thing comes in. An incredibly brutal childhood under a tyrannical grandfather who insisted he had to go into the family business. And then a very probably neglectful, also brutal schooling environment in the Guild of Fools, where he says, like, that, you know, you could hear the other kids crying, yes. And they are, it's beaten into them, these are the approved jokes, these are the approved things, you must learn to caper, you must learn to juggle, and it's almost like they're using misery and yes. torment to train children to make others laugh.
They have approved jokes, you cannot be, he gets beaten for attempting to tell a joke that is not one of the approved jokes.
Yeah, he made up a joke as a kid, as children do, and yes. So that's also incredibly grim.
Yeah, and then they talk about it being next door to the Assassin's Guild. Assassin's Guild will come up more next time. The sounds of them playing, the Assassin's Guild, you know, the sounds of laughter and joy coming from the Assassin's Guild, although that does get less as they get older.
But yes, it's the fact that the Assassin's Guild is clearly a happier and merrier place than the Guild of Fools.
Yeah, I'm trying to find the...
And also the fact that when he goes out places, they learn that some people just have conversations and make each other laugh without any reference to all of the texts and the rules. And it's like it's not allowed... So nothing's allowed to be spontaneous or humorous. And again, I feel like Pratchett is a humorist. Like, this is obviously making a point there. The thing with the fool is that he's a very intelligent guy, but very duty bound. Yes. So he doesn't like being a fool. He doesn't want to be a fool, but that is what he is. And he doesn't like Felmet or the Duchess. But he has sworn to be their fool and serve them. So I assume it's a bit odd because I think he obviously comes from Lanker, but then he seems to have kind of taken up with Felmet at some point, like that's where he's been employed. It's not that bit's kind of slightly missing from his background.
I think he was the previous king's fool.
Oh, is he just the fool of whoever's the king?
Yes, because okay. Remember he was yes. hiding in that he was in the hall yeah. In the shadow. So
no one was there. No one saw. There couldn't have been anyone there.
Yes. No. Okay. I apologize for implying that.
Yeah, so he's mostly talking to Felmet, but also the Duchess as well, particularly when Felmet's doing this thing and goes round and round. So the stuff where, you know, he's trying to say lines he's supposed to, like, you know, hey, nonny, nonny, if faith, nuncle. And Felmet's like, I'm not your nuncle. And then Duchess says something, and he's like, nant? And so there's this kind of, like, Shakespearean-esque fooling language that's in there that he's having to do and has been beaten into him and trained. When they actually get him to answer questions straight, rather than trying to do his whole capering act, he's actually very smart. And what he's doing is basically harm reduction.
Yes.
Because they're a bit like, we'll burn down all the forests. If the trees are bothering you, burn them all down. Burn down the cottages. If anyone's whispering about you, just, you know, destroy people, torture them, execute them. And he's like, no, that will cause more unrest and more problems. And like, well, what would you do? And he basically explains propaganda to the Duke and Duchess, and he explains, you know, oh, well, you're not just chopping down the forests, it's increasing
industrial base.
Yeah, increasing timber, rural clearing, and he just basically uses all these buzzwords and, like, basically ways of, like, we're doing something bad, we're going to make it sound good. You know, burning down houses, it's like increased heating.
Yeah.
The Duke and Duchess, who are just like, I mean, oh, well, the Duke goes round and round on his same few things, but does sometimes get, I guess, lucid enough to listen. But the Duchess, who's always just been a bit like, well, you know, other people are nothing to her. But she's sort of interested in this. Oh, you know, like, will that increase our power? Will that make it better? And his thought is, he doesn't like saying this, but it's his job to, you know, be the fool, to advise. I mean, traditionally, a fool would kind of speak truth to power. Obviously, that would be incredibly dangerous here. But he's using words and explaining to them how to kind of rewrite history, use words to change people's perceptions, which is obviously incredibly dangerous and damaging, but he's doing it because he knows the alternative is people will be locked up and people will be tortured and people will be murdered. So he's trying, again, it's harm reduction. He's not doing a good thing, but he's trying to do a less bad thing.
In some ways showing how words have power, much how Granny Weatherwax uses words.
Well, I don't know. I feel like Granny...
Well, it's Granny, I think they're
different. Granny isn't so much with words, but more, I think, it's not just words. It's also, I guess, her presence and...
But there are similarities. Sort of and yeah. You know, and at the start where the, you know, they have the baby and the guards are there and how she sort of, instead of, you know, rather than using magic to, you know, they're this chief guard who is threatening them all. He's, what are you going to do? Strike me down with lightning? It's like, no, she did was talk. And one of the other guards, who was a Lanka, did for the chief guard, knowing it's like, well, I don't want to get on the bad side of the witches. It's using...
Yeah, it's knowing who your audience is and knowing how to say things.
Yeah.
And so that's where the idea of the play comes along, because the Duchess is a bit like, you know, we don't want people talking about staircases, even though obviously that's the main thing Duke ever talks about, entirely unprompted.
And the Duke's the more than most of the liability here.
Well, absolutely. And they want the witches to be bad. So the Duke and Duchess know that the witches were given the baby and then the baby disappeared, as did the crown. And they kind of have left that because they've realised the witches are popular enough and have enough sway that they can't just...
Yeah, they try and tax them. And
oh, yeah, yeah, that's it. They try and get to pay taxes, it doesn't really work. Because all the Lanka people still have an inherent respect for witches because they're part of their communities and they're, you know, they're not always liked, but they're a helpful part and vital part of the community, really. So in order to turn people against them, you've got to do something else. So that's why the Fool is sent off to go to Ankh-Morpork and find some people who can do plays, because he kind of explains the concept of theatre to them. It's like, well, no, if you... I think Duchess says, well, how can we change things that already happened? It's like, well, you just have to change what the story was. And so he's sent out to find people who can do a play that goes on about the great king who saved the country from the terrible king before and the evil witches.
Yeah. So this moves nicely into talking about the other small aspect of this, which is the players, the theatre troupe. At the start of the book, the baby is given to the witches and they proceed to...
Although they say baby, they say, oh, he can't be more than 2 years old. And I'm like, well, that's a toddler and that's a bit different. But they kind of treat him like a baby, like he's quiet and just bundled about. So,
I mean, anyway. The exact age is, you know. Yeah. So who gets named Tom John because comedy of naming.
But yeah, basically there are some actors in Lanka the same night that the Duke kills the king, although they don't know anything about this somewhere else, and they just sort of say, look, you're leaving, do you want to take this child with you? And the couple that run the theatre troupe don't have their own kids but would like them, so yeah, they take him in.
And with a big bag of gold as well.
Yeah, they also have a big bag of gold.
Yeah, so we get the theatre troupe, and the two key members is the owner,
Vitola,
and we get the dwarven playwright, Hwel.
It looks real Welsh, but yes. I don't know. We'll go with that.
We'll go with that. and they take Tom John off with them, and the crown hidden in
a... Well, the crown has just been put in their cart, which, because they're doing, you know, Shakespeare-y type plays, just has a lot of stuff where there's various, you know, odd events that mean various people becoming kings or scheming to be kings. It's quite funny because Magrat understands what the theatre is, but Granny's never seen anything like that. So at first she thinks it's real, and it's like, he killed that other guy. And it's, there's just a slyrish thing where the actors are trying to act, and like, you know, Nanny's just watching on, but yammering to everyone.
Yeah.
And then Granny's there just like, but he's a murderer. It's like, but why is this guy standing up? He was dead a minute ago. Because she's not quite understood acting. Because if you've not seen it before and aren't from a tradition of that, it probably is quite weird.
Yeah.
So yeah, Vitola is this very charismatic actor guy who in my head sounds a bit like either Tim Curry or Matt Berry.
I can see that, yes.
Yeah, just very, you know, because he plays all the
big roles.
Yeah. And then, you know, as they take the little boy away and, you know, raise him as their own, as soon as he doesn't talk for ages, and his first words is him doing a speech exactly as his father did it.
Because the witches do the traditional godmother, you know, fairy godmother. He gets three gifts, one of which is never to forget the word.
Mm-hmm.
Or the other one is to always know who he is.
Mm-hmm.
And the third one, I now can't remember.
I've forgotten that bit entirely. But yeah, I think it's because Magrat has decided, oh, if we're godmothers, we need to bestow them with gifts. Because Tom John doesn't remember Lanka or any of this, so he just thinks he was raised in the theatre. They go travelling, they go to a lot of small places, they end up in Ankh-Morpork. Yes, we'll get to time in a minute, but then they're sort of like looking to put down roots and establish an actual theatre site. It's that Tom John can impersonate anyone and any speech. He's basically like, say, the perfect actor, but he always embodies it exactly. And if he impersonates somebody, it's a massive impersonation, even if the person he's pretending to be is entirely different to him. When he plays
anthropomorphic personification.
Yeah, we'll get to that. And then you've got Hwel, who... So Hwel is a dwarf, and in this it's made clear that dwarves usually live under mountains and mine, and that's their whole thing. And they have, and in Ankh-Morpork, they have their own bars, and they quaff beer, and which is mostly spilling it or something.
Yes.
And they sing about gold, and that's the focus. So this starts a lot of the kind of template of dwarves, because there's not been a huge amount of dwarves so far. Just the odd one. I think the one in, like, Fantastic was the main one who had the speaking part.
And we're seeing the template of urban dwarves as well. The idea of, that they're shopkeepers. They have, you know, they're doing other jobs within the... When they get together, it's all chainmail, axes and quaffing.
Yeah. So Hwel's very different because he... Well, sorcery introduced the idea of the inspiration particles that sleep through the multiverse and hit the right person at the right time. Hwel is somebody who is like a lightning rod for these things. Yes. Stuff is hitting him all the time, and you see him thinking things through, and you see him coming up with drafts and scribbling stuff out, coming up with something else. So he's very much the writer of the thing. Yes, so I feel like
he's like half of Shakespeare. He's the writer half of Shakespeare, whereas Vitoli is kind of the actor and businessman. The theatre owner.
Yeah, I think other people did a lot of that stuff for Shakespeare.
But Hwel is there as the writer. And
so you've got the progression from touring players who go from town to town. You know, they've got their carts, which then become the stages. Everything's on sacking. I mean, the reason the crown is hidden is because it's quite dull looking compared to all the prop costume crowns. And it's just in the bottom of a box. So it's there for, you know, years. But then they go to Ankh-Morpork and they do well, partly because of Tom John, no doubt, being so impressive.
Yes.
And because of Hwel writing such good stuff. Just in case anyone can hear dogs, our neighbours' dogs are, you know, barking as dogs do. So you've got this, basically, these two theatrical, you know, superstars. So they've made enough money that they can actually settle down. And what they're doing in Ankh-Morpork is they are building the disc. It's spelt with a Y.
Yes.
And because Hwel wants to put his vision on stage, and he has visions of wave machines and things that make storm that isn't just a guy rattling a piece of tin. Theatrical effects and stagecraft and trapdoors and entrances and like gods that can come down from the heaven and demons that can come up through trapdoors.
Because he's seeing every, I think his inspiration is just so much, he's seeing so much of what we know as...
What he's seeing, and Pratchett does this to just put in tons of references, is basically a lot of theatrical stuff, musical stuff, silent film, and also like early film comedies. Yes. So what there are that I identified were references to Charlie Chaplin, Laurel and Hardy, what I think is the Marx Brothers, although I don't know their work very well.
No, I think you're right.
You just remember Groucho, really.
Yeah.
There's one bit where he's writing something that's clearly a panto whilst also being Richard III.
Yep. That was not a combination.
I think Pratchett's just like, you know what, just mash this together, because the point is he's being hit by inspiration particles. Yeah, he's just putting stuff together. And again, the idea of somebody who's scribbling stuff down, who's constantly thinking, who's constantly working on stuff. If you look at how productive Pratchett is as a novelist,
yes,
got all this stuff coming. Can I get it in? Where can I put this? Oh, I've got an idea for this. Can I put that in? Can I put that in? You know? Yeah. So yeah, I think that's probably quite true to the author. There's also, I think there's a bit where he's writing something that's clearly part of a restoration comedy with the whole, you know, kind of saucy farce. And then there's stuff that's references to US war movies. There's just like, and it's just little bits. It's all these references sprinkled in the bits with Hwel.
With through the lens of the Discworld as well.
I think the point is that Hwel's just getting it almost in raw form and having to kind of interpret it.
That's what he's interpreting it through as, you know.
Yeah, it's not like he's seeing a television going, oh, what's that?
No,
He's seeing the show and being like, oh, here's like a funny little tramp guy who has an odd little mustache and walks in a strange way. Yeah. Again, imagining what the theatre could be and wanting to have that as a place. And then Vitola wants to, because him and Hwel obviously go back a long way. I think Hwel was, we've said, he's not like a regular dwarf. He's writing things all the time. He's not good at mining. Hwel's kind of picked up by Vitola, and then they go and start this theatre company. And so they've obviously got this deep friendship to the point where Vitola can use a word that would normally be incredibly offensive for a human to say to a dwarf, but kind of in a, you know, we go back a long way, so I'm kind of calling this as a term of endearment, even though it's actually probably a slur. And then later, then Tom John can't do that. But then later, as they go for more stuff, he kind of earns that right with Hwel. Because again, you've got to think that Hwel's kind of is, you know, he's in a largely human space. though he is a dwarf, but he's not like most dwarfs because, you know, he's got a different focus to a lot of them. So culturally, I guess he's quite different to, from where he comes from, and he's had to forge his own path. And Vitola is seeing how Tom John is. He wants to make the space for them both. You know, you've got his son, you've got his best friend, and kind of, I think, it's not quite brother in arms, brother in
quills,
thespianism, brother in theatricality, I don't know. And he wants that space for them, but then it means he's in quite a lot of debt. So when the fool comes and says, oh, this guy up in the mountains wants you to, like, write a play with, like, an evil king who's supported by witches who gets deposed by a good king, and so Whelz writing that, and so they, although they've obviously been stationary and performing in Ankh-Morpork for a while, it's like, oh, we'll take some of the younger lads from the company out and go up into the mountains, and yeah, it can be a bit of a tour. And
so at this point, I think it might be worth pointing out, so we were talking about, you know, the Duke being in charge for about a year, but also we're talking about Tom John, who was a baby and is now an actor, you know, and he's not a toddler actor, it's in Lankra. Granny gets...
The Duke crosses the line. Nanny goes into the castle to find Grebo, who's been trapped by the ghost of the previous king because he wanted the witch to talk to. But then what happens is she's just walking down the corridor to find her cat. And then the Duke turns around the corridor full of paranoia and the idea that the trees and the witch starts to get him, sees a witch near his bedroom and is like, they've come for me. And so Nanny gets put in the dungeon. And the idea is you're not allowed to lock a witch up. Yes. And her son is one of the guards, so he runs out to find Granny. He finds Magrat first.
The concern is that the Og family would, if all the Og family rose up, it would be a bit of a problem for Lankra.
Yes. And this is after Granny... So Granny was borrowing and then felt something, a weird mind she couldn't understand from somewhere, goes out into the forest, and then all these creatures who would normally predate on each other or be fleeing each other are there, and she realises the kingdom doesn't like Thelmet.
No, I think the kingdom wants someone that cares about
it. Yeah, that's the thing.
I think the head of state, it doesn't matter.
Like if he's cruel to people, yeah, or exactly, not very nice.
But Thelmet doesn't care for the kingdom.
Yes.
And that is what, you know, the kingdom wants someone that wants it, that wants them to...
And I think that only Granny, with her incredible powers of borrowing and that kind of like mind sense, can read that. So yeah, they've already got a bit of, I guess, permission. Because there's this whole thing about, oh, we mustn't interfere. Which is funny because interfering old baggages is probably quite a good description of Granny and Nanny. They wouldn't touch their faces.
No, I mean, clearly. Give them an inch, they'll take a mile, kind of, you know, they will interfere, you know.
But the idea is that they're not supposed to interfere. Well, they're almost a bit dismissive of kings. Oh, kings don't matter. Kings come and go. Yeah. But, you know, they're in the community. The witch is there. The kings treat them with respect. You know, Nanny always says, you know, the king would be like, oh, you know, good day, Mrs. Og, when he was hunting.
Yeah, send them aside, side of venison down, you know.
I think it's that Thelmet doesn't respect them, but also he doesn't respect or like or care for the kingdom. This is the thing, that they have what seems to be a showdown. Granny and Magrat go to rescue Nanny. Nanny takes one of the stones to the castle so she can talk to the king later. But it seems almost like Granny hands him. But then Thelmet, who obviously wasn't quite a smart guy and devious and scheming, but had smarts to him, although obviously his increasingly bad mental state gets rid of it. But Thelmet actually says to Granny, says that if Granny disposes him, it's like that whoever she replaced him with would have to be a fool indeed.
They would.
Which, yes, because the idea is that they wouldn't be king. They'd just be somebody who's propped up by witches and everyone would know that. It's also foreshadowing.
Yes.
So, yeah, so what happens is when Thelmet really crosses the line with that, there's talk of Black Alice.
Yes.
Who's the witch who started Gingerbread Cottage craze.
Yes.
But also she sent the cast asleep for 100 years. But she didn't really. What she was, she just moved 100 years into the future and then fawns all grew around it. So what they decide, they've had a year of Thelmet, and he even says, fine, bring the baby back. Yeah. So he says it'll be years, and by that time he'll be entrenched, he'll be unstoppable. Yeah. So like, we don't have time, but because they're still thinking destiny, you know, the kid's got a destiny to him, the crown, you know, the crown kind of like, if you wear it, it's got this power to it.
It's kind of like the Arch Chancellor's hat, a little bit, without the stupidly powerful magic.
Well, the kings aren't magic, are they? The whole point is magic isn't supposed to rule. That's the other thing. Yes. Magic isn't supposed to be used to rule.
Yeah, but in this situation, it's just the crown, you know, is more than just a symbol. It has a weight of...
So yeah, what Granny does, she almost has to be sort of half talked around to it, because there's an idea of, like, you don't want to start cackling. You don't want to be like Black Alice, because she went bad in the end. And
locked in her in an oven.
Yes. So what they do is, with Granny and Magrat's, sorry, with Nanny and Magrat's help, although large, I think, is batteries, they take their broomsticks. Yeah,
they're purely there as batteries.
They take their broomsticks and they move the entire country of Lanka 15 years into the future, and they do it in one night.
Yeah. Well, they have to. Well, one night and a bit. I believe that the spell has to be done before the first cockerel crows,
yes,
in the door.
Yes, and so what? Yeah. So.
which is great, because, you know, obviously Nanny has every faith in that it's going to happen, but she obviously thought, well, let's just have a backup, and got the 30 or so grandchildren that she's got
into Og Clan
to go around and basically basically muffle every single cockerel that was about to, it's, you know,
in Lanka, yeah. Yeah,
the idea, you can hear it to the, it's on the end of this, well, when they're flying to the end, and you just hear this kind of, like, you know,
yes, they're trying to crow and they're being stopped, and then Granny, I think Granny half knows this is happening but won't admit to it, and Nanny won't admit to it because Nanny's helping her and Granny doesn't want to admit she needs help, whilst also having to maintain a certain amount of modesty. Oh, she couldn't really, even though she knows she could, because this is the thing, for all the headology and stuff, Granny is an incredibly powerful witch.
Yes.
And Nanny is nowhere near as powerful witch-wise, but is very practical and has a lot more people on her side.
Which is why they make a good team.
Until they don't, because there is a bit in the book where everyone has a big row and the squabbling falls out.
But anyway, so this is why we get moving 15 years in the future. So there's a bit of it talked about in the book about practicalities of an area of the country disappearing.
Whole country.
Yes.
It's a small country.
Small country.
And very rural.
Very. I think it'd have to be very, very, very rural.
It is very rural.
There are bits where they start getting, the citizens of Lanka start getting very confused about what's happened or not happened. And so, yes, so this is why we get the triumphant return of Tom John at the head of
a group of players. Good. One thing I want to mention before we go on to that is the romance.
Yes.
So in amongst this, Magra ends up meeting the fool in a meadow, and it's clear they both like each other, but they're also incredibly inexperienced and both kind of have their own things to focus on with their work. And then Magra's not sure what to do, and the fool's obviously interested, and she's playing hard to get and doing the, oh, I'm washing my hair thing. There's allusions to the fool's bad backstory at various points, and then he actually tells Magra all of it. So that's happening. But there's a bit where Magra keeps thinking of him as a silly little man, and then Nanny, I mean, this is the kind of thing Granny wouldn't know about, because Granny is not interested in that sort of thing at all, whereas Nanny, as we said, adventurous girlhood and several husbands, says to Magra, don't look at him as a woman, look at him as a witch.
Yeah.
Because the point of, against that magic user thing of being able to see what's really there, and Magra sees, the fool isn't a funny little man. He is a regular-sized man who is making himself small. He is always capering and moving about because that's what he's trained to do. His whole thing is to kind of be not too noticeable. He tinkles slightly because of the bells, but he's supposed to be a figure of fun. He's supposed to be non-threatening and silly and a bit nonsense. And actually, he's a very serious, thoughtful individual, but that's not what he's supposed to be. So his whole life is a performance. This is the thing, because Tom John's there as literally an incredible actor and mimic and impersonator who can, like, say a speech somebody else has written and stir people. The fool is somebody who is making himself, his whole existence, something silly and small and disguised as sort of nonsense.
Yeah.
And so it's the idea that they're both doing, like, if you look at two of them, they're doing this performance.
Yes.
Speaking of looking two of them together, obviously the fool goes to Ankh-Morpork Pork. He says, you know, we've got money, come up to the mountains, do a play.
Yeah.
They go off. And yeah, Tom John arrives with the players.
I think we
players.
Have a certain amount of destiny that means that they meet up.
Yes.
I think, you know, while destiny isn't as working quite how I think the witches are expecting it to.
Well, that's the thing, because while Hwel's getting all these dreams of all sorts of things, Tom John is getting dreams of these weird distorted faces who keep commenting on what he's doing. unbeknownst to him, it's the three witches who, rather than using a crystal ball, have an a fishing lure that Nanny has in her. This is the thing. All of Nanny's magic is very practical. It's a bit like, well, I'm going to use a wash tub, and I'm going to use like washing implements and things. I'm going to use stuff that's around the house for magic. And Magritte's there a bit like it probably should be like more mystical. Yeah. And it's like, we're just going to use what's here, you know. But the witches have still got the capital D destiny in their heads. He's going to come back with the crown and with an army and fight the Duke. And he just seems to be players and like, oh, but they must be pretending. Oh, you know, the crown's hidden in there. They must be.
The wagons are full of weapons and they're going to jump out. And it's like, well, they might jump out, but most likely in makeup.
Declaim something.
Yes, yeah.
There will be a soliloquy.
Yeah. So you know, we have the big dramatic play at the end. The witches are there waiting any moment for Tom John to stand up and
stab
declare
the Duke
and start, you know, take back his rightful crown.
Whereas,
and instead, what they're watching is a play which is basically
Tom John's playing the evil king,
character assassinating them, and the old
King Beren, who isn't very happy as a ghost. This thing, Tom John goes to his castle and he can immediately hear this like weird whispering all the time. It's all a bit weird for him. This sort of stage of theatre is one where it's all male.
Yeah.
So you have these actors who are playing the witches and it's all going a bit wrong. And it's like, well, they're going, you know, this is the big thing. They've been paid all this money. It's going to pay for the Disc Theatre back in Ankh-Morpork to do this. And he can tell it's going a bit wrong. And everyone seems to be a bit wigged out. And, oh, the storm. So the storm. Bless the storm. So throughout the book, from the first bit
The storm in the first paragraph.
Well, so it says, the storm has strutted its hour, which is obviously a reference to, you know, Shakespeare line. There's basically this storm who is constantly in the backdrop. So Rishoff just mentioned what it's doing. And it's basically like a jobbing actor. So, you know, it's trying to get itself known. It's done some bits of, you know, stuff here and there. And the whole point is every so often this storm will just be there and there'll be a storm. And it'll be this storm who's just waiting for its big break. And, you know, oh, it's taken part in this and that. It's gone, you know, up over up the ramtops. So the whole point is like this jobbing actor. And then you get to this thing and suddenly somebody says something about the storm, and then the storm comes down, breaks the tower, and the guy who's supposed to be wibbling a bit of card, a bit of metal, is like, what? Because the storm has, like, seen its moment. So it's just this kind of weird background of, like, so it's called pathetic fallacy when, obviously, the backdrop in a work of fiction mimics what's happening. But here, Pratt's just actually giving it personality. It is a jobbing actor, but as a storm. And then at the end, it sort of says, you know, it gets its chance. Like, it was going to take them by, well, tempest. So it's just, again, the illusions in this, and you know, there's a lot and it's fun. But then you have this thing where you've got the whole idea where you have a play and it's going wrong and the witches are there, and what happens is Granny can see it's a magic, but it's not magic. It's like a dodgy, because as people are watching the play, which Huell had trouble with because it didn't quite seem right, but you know, he's writing what he was sort of told to write. And they've got all these witches, and there's lots of lines from Shakespeare, and there's a bit about ditch delivered by a drab. And Nanny's a bit like, wait, that's me. And she's thinking, oh, I know which girl that is. She didn't tell her mum what happened. And then they realise, you know, and she's like, it's saying we put babies in the cauldron. We don't put babies in the cauldron. The, I guess, slander, the character assassination, because it's being performed, it's like real. And you can see that the audience going, well, this is how it was. And so, and Granny's uncomfortable with this because it's a magic she doesn't deal with, but it's clearly having an effect on people.
Because so, the Duke decides he's had enough, and you know, he decides to arrest the witches. Yeah, so he sends his men to arrest the witches, and of course they arrest the actors playing the witches.
They've seen three witches. They're clearly witches. They're covered in warts. They've got a load of hair that's all straw like, and they put them in a dungeon.
And so the witch, our witches
are forced on stage.
Yeah, are kind of sitting, are kind of huddling backstage, trying to work out what to do.
And then Huell, who as well as playwriting a stage, managing it and having to give people a lot of pep talks because it's a
and
weird
prompts.
Night. Yes, he's doing a lot of prompts. He forces them on stage. So yeah, they're then in the play. The other thing you have is also one character in the play is Death.
Yes.
And there's a lad who's, you know, been practicing his lines. I am Death against whom no holds a bard nor locks contain or something like that. And he's trying to remember his lines. And then Death shows up, and it's interesting because Death Again, he's sort of trying to understand humans. He has things like, Death was intrigued. They thought they wanted to be taken out of themselves, and every art humans dreamt up took them further in. And it's a great idea of, like, is it escapism? It's like, well, on one level, but on the other hand, you're going further into what it is to be human, which I think is a very Pratchett thing. It's such it's such a great wider point. But yes, at one point, Death sees somebody who's supposed to be playing him going back and forth, not remembering the lines. And then what happens to him?
I can't remember.
For some reason, he's not able to. I mean, he's fine.
I think he just faints because he sees Death.
He sees the Grim Reaper, yeah. Despite not being magic, but I guess being in that frame of mind.
Yeah.
And so then Death goes on stage. Oh, you know, he has his big moment. And then he gets a stage fright.
But it says, you know, for someone who is not noticed to have every pair of eyes on him, you know.
Yeah, because at that point they do see the Grim Reaper, because this is the point when the Grim Reaper's in the page, yes. In the stage.
You know, it's quite fun. It's just like, you know, he goes, because he's prompting the guy in the back, because he's messing up his lines, and he's going, oh, this is your... And then when he goes on, that he makes the same mess up that the guy at the back.
Yeah, the play all goes wrong. There's a prop dagger, and what happens?
Well, the more important, not the play.
The witches.
I think Granny Rowlatt gets fed up and basically goes, "Let the truth be known."
Mm.
And so the reason that there's been so many problems with the play is because
it's the wrong way around.
The players all hearing whispers of what the true line should be, what really happened,
because King Varys is
not so much Varys whisper. I think it's just that
the stones remember, all the ghosts remember, all the ghosts.
The whole point is they're trying to tell us they're fighting against
the history of history. Yeah, happened.
These words that the players then start speaking the true words.
Depicting what actually happened. Well, I kind of thought it was that King Varys kind of possesses Tom John, who is obviously his biological son, and he sort of describes what happens. And then, but yeah, the guy who's playing the supposedly good king, who's the Duke, is suddenly revealed to have killed the bad king, who's Varys. And Felmet, having been strenuously denying all of this for like over a year with no prompting, fully loses his wits. And there's a prop dagger, and various people think they've killed people. So they think the fool has died and Magrat is holding him because she'd been trying to play a bit hard to get or wasn't sure, but then she thinks he's dead. And so she's holding him. And then Felmet ends up getting stabbed.
Well, this is why he thinks he's dead.
And this thing, he thinks, oh, I'm dead. And he goes, I'm a ghost. And then Death's following him because he can see Death now. Like, oh, I'm dead. And Death's like, no, you aren't. And he's like, yes, I am. I can see you. And he's like, well, no, I'm here for later. And he's like looking at Felmet's lifetime and going, no, it's fine. And Felmet's going, I'm a ghost. See, I'm running through walls. And he keeps pretending he has ghost powers, but doesn't. And then it's only when he actually goes, well, look, I can fly, and throws himself off the balcony. It's like, oh, okay, now it's now he's dead.
But the important thing is that the dagger is the magic sword.
Oh.
Because, you know, the whole point is like, the film, it comes on and it stabs the fool, and, you know, because the fool comes out and says, no, what the players are saying is true. Yeah. I saw it.
Yeah, this thing, the fool bears witness. The fool has, that's the other thing. The fool is tortured because this entire time he saw that Felmet killed the king because he was in the corridor and saw it. But because he has to be loyal to the Duke, he doesn't say anything, which seems a bit odd because, like, well, he killed the previous guy you're supposed to be loyal to. But I think the loyalty is supposed to be passed along anyway. But yeah, so the fool's known the truth the whole time and then reveals it. And so...
And gets stabbed, you know.
We think he's dead, but it's a prop dagger.
Yes.
Because it's a play.
So, and, you know, the witches have been going on about this, you know, coming in with a magical sword throughout. And, you know, this is a magical sword. It's a dagger that doesn't actually kill him.
Because he's an actor. Yes. So again, it gets very Shakespearean.
Big Shakespearean dramatic conclusion to that.
There's lots of mistaken identities, and the truth is revealed, and like people get stabbed, but it's a prop dagger because we're also being very meta and talking about the theatre. So what happens is Tom John is told, oh, well, no, you're the king. And he's like, what? And it's like, well, no, because your father was the king and you were smuggled away, because he knew he was from Lancre. He knew he'd been born in Lancre, but he hadn't been told he was adopted. You know, Quell says that's what happens, and suddenly he's sitting there going, but I don't want to be the king. And all these people are suddenly around him planning stuff, and he just wants to act.
Yes.
He's an actor, and Quell's a bit like, Quell gets very into his, like, fiction stories, and he's a bit like, oh, but if you're king, you could, you know, you could build a theatre here, or you could have players here. It's like, oh, king's quite a performance. And Tom John's like, but you're not writing the words for me. And Is it Nanny who sees it? Gran is there just trying to herd him into it. You know, she has done a lot for this destiny. This is the destiny that's happening. It's all planned. But he doesn't want to, and he's clearly trying to make it not happen. Everyone's been like, oh, you're going to be king. And it's like, this was never something he wanted. So, yeah. So then Nanny comes forward with a reveal. One thing we find out earlier in the story, when Magra is interested in the Fool and is trying to, I guess, suss him out a bit, she does like a kind of like a little kind of trick that the young girls do to sort of find out the name of the guy you like. And she discovers that the Fool's name is Varin. But it's not unusual for people to be named after the king.
Yeah.
And then Nanny comes forward and it's a bit like, oh, well, actually, there's been jokes throughout about, is it Droit de Seigneur or something? Yeah. Basically, the idea of kings going and taking their pleasure with, you know, the residents of the kingdom. It's sort of told in a slightly jokey way. And again, it's, you wouldn't necessarily completely get it, because like Magrat kind of doesn't. And there's almost this weird thing where people talk about it and they're acting like they think they're talking about a dog. Like, you know, they think you talk about, oh, he'd always take this out. And they think, oh, you're talking about like one of those big dogs you have in the castle. And it's like, no, it's actually, it, you know, it's obviously it's a double entendre. But what is implied is that the Fool, Varence, is actually also a son of King Varence and therefore could have the crown. And there's the whole thing, because Hwel noticed as soon as the Fool and Tom John were standing together in Ankh-Morpork, they looked really, really similar. And even Hwel's a bit like, oh, there's some sort of destiny thing happening here. And again, it's a bit of a jump cut, isn't it? It's this thing, practically, it's like, we've not quite figured this out. So jump cuts later and the witches are talking about it. And Magrat's still interested in Varence, but suddenly he's very busy because he's not the Fool anymore, he's Varence, and he's becoming the king. And suddenly Magrat can't get his attention. So where before she kept going, oh, I'm washing my hair every time he suggested they you know, do something together or try to make a date with her. Suddenly her hair is unwashed and she's really sad because he's been so busy. But then Nanny reveals, so Nanny's the midwife. Nanny knows what's going on in a different way to Granny and reveals that, oh yeah, the previous Fool, Berence's father, he was a very handsome and likable young man who skipped out the kingdom pretty early on when he was little. And oh, the queen did find him so funny. And I think the implication is that Varin, the new King Varence, he's somebody's son. Was he the king's son or?
There might be a couple of ways of reading it. The Fool's father, who made friends easily and very athletic and can climb walls like nobody's business. And
which goes back to that kind of whole restoration
and obviously
comedy.
You've got the king used to go out hunting a lot.
He didn't pay much attention. He didn't seem very
hardly ever home at night.
Doting as a husband. Or something. It's not really clear exactly what happened, but yeah, it's
No, I see. I reckon the Fool's mother is his mother.
Yeah.
But not the queen. Tom John's the child of the Fool's father and the queen.
Okay.
So they both have the same father.
Oh, I thought they both had the same mother.
No, I think queen.
They're definitely brothers, half-brothers, and the new King Varence is not actually the old King Varence's son, but he likes the country, he's a sensible guy, so they've put him in charge.
They do talk about the Fool's father coming back every now and again.
Oh, yeah.
He does come back to see them. He's not completely gone.
Okay, so there's different ways of reading it. We've taken different things from this, but that's fine.
That's fine. Yeah, it's quite, you know, this is the whole point of this.
Editing Kathy here, just to say that we will be talking about sexual harassment in the book and sexual violence more generally in fantasy. So if you prefer not to listen to that, skip ahead about 3.5 minutes.
Do we want to briefly talk about the unfortunate bit in the dungeon?
Oh, yeah. As I said in the content note, when Magrat is going to rescue Nanny, Felmet has brought in his own guards who aren't from Lanka, don't have respect for witches. And there is a bit...
women in general.
Well, no. And there is a bit where, yeah, basically Magrat is cornered and a guard is clearly groping her. You know, they make some threats. The Fool yells at him to stop and distracts him enough that Magrat can kind of get away. And that is unpleasant. The thing is, the book, you know, it actually uses the word sexual harassment.
Yeah.
And obviously it's to show villainousness.
Well, this is the thing. We know it's a villain shorthand.
But what occurred to me is a lot of the books I read, like fantasy books I read when I was a teenager, there was this implied stuff, and it wasn't for spectacle. It's just like, these are bad people and they're like assaulting a young woman. Yeah. You know, someone I know bounced off of it because of that. It is named and it is shown as a bad thing, and it's not done to titillate.
Yeah.
So it's a difficult thing to read. I think it's part of like the genre at the time, but at least he's called out what it is.
Could be worse, but on the other hand...
I mean, it's not funny, though, obviously.
You know, 1988, slightly different to now. Do we need to show people being evil by the how they treat women? I think that's a definite no, you know.
Well, it depends. A lot of stuff would have sexual assault and rape as like almost backgrounds, and the idea is, oh, here's a female character, she's under constant threat of sexual violence, and that is quite a tropey thing in the genre. I think it happened for some time, and Pratchett has, yeah, this is a thing that happens. It's not great that that's the situation, but he's not sort of saying, well, this is naturally how it is obviously in previous times. So it's not, I guess, a psychological part of the book, but it is named as like, this is sexual harassment, it's bad, this is a villain. Yeah. Not like, well, of course a woman out on her own is going to be in danger, for these are dark, barbaric times.
Of course.
As if, you know, somehow that didn't happen.
It could be argued we live in dark, barbaric times.
Yeah, true.
I can't remember of any other instances where, you know, even in future books.
No, but when it was mentioned, I was like, oh, I can see which bit of the book that was in. So I kind of almost was primed to notice it more. And again, I think I'd notice that kind of thing more now.
Yeah.
I don't think it's so much of a thing in the other books. If one is worried about that sort of thing, the Tiffany Aching books don't have it because they're specifically YA.
Yes.
So yeah, I mean, I think there are times when there's, you know, suggestion. There are some quite nasty people in some of the other books, particularly, you know, some like the Guards books where they're dealing with particularly nasty criminals. But I guess we'll see
it'll be interesting to...
It's not something where rape and sexual assault is used as wallpaper, which does happen in various fantasy series, including ones written since this, and also
the Grimdark.
Even you look at Game of Thrones.
Yes, true.
It's kind of a thing in fantasy. So I think having it in didn't feel unusual to me as somebody who'd read quite a bit of fantasy, but was probably a little bit immature. Perhaps it calls, what is it? Sexual harassment. There's no going around it, or just kind of treating it like, well, this is a natural consequence of being a woman in such a world. You know, in fact, what we see in this is mostly that the women in this are incredibly powerful individuals.
I would not mess with any of those three.
Or indeed, you know, the other female characters in it. I mean, the Duchess is a monster.
True. Would not miss
But her she's an incredibly powerful monster.
Yes.
It takes a kingdom to take her out.
True, yes. She does get her comeuppance by the kingdom.
I just wanted to mention a few absolute killer lines. Only in our dreams are we three. The rest of the time we need wages.
Fair.
And then, genuine anger was one of the world's great creative forces, but you have to learn how to control it. And I feel like, yes, Gran is thinking that, but good lord, is that not Sir Terry?
Yes.
Oh, the other thing I was going to mention is this is the first time that Leonard of Quirm is mentioned.
Oh, yes, Leonard of Quirm.
Because he invented the wave machine for the disc theatre.
Yes, Leonard of Quirm will be coming back later.
He is a daft old chap from the Street of Cunning Artificers who does this as a hobby, but is mostly a painter.
Yeah. Final thoughts. I mean, I think it's fair to say we both thoroughly enjoyed it. It's one of the definite great starting points for the whole series as a whole.
Certainly for the witches.
If you enjoy the witches, this is where you're starting. I think it does a good job of introducing the world and, you know, to bits of it. You get to see a bit of Hank Moorpork.
But it's mostly Lanker.
But you know, you get a feel for his style. I think he sticks the ending, which, you know, of some of the previous books have been a little...
It does do that jump a bit where everyone's talking about what just happened, but it feels less bad than in more.
It's, you knew what was going to happen.
And you can see the kind of through line of it, even if the exact mechanisms...
I don't think you necessarily needed to see those conversations.
No.
You know? I think it's perfectly fair.
Yeah, I think this is definitely one we recommend.
I mean, let's be fair, I don't think we haven't recommended one yet.
We didn't recommend Equal Rights.
I mean, some of them have been less recommended than others. That's it. So next time we will be moving on to Pyramids.
Thank you for listening.
And we will see you in the future. Thank you for listening to Dining Table Discworld. You can find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com facebook.com/diningtablediscworld. You can also find us on Blue Sky at DT Discworld. All our other contact information and credits for our music can be found in our show notes. Thank you for listening again, and we'll see you in our next episode.